Hello and welcome to the Cyber Sisters podcast. We're your Cyber Sisters, Allison and Emily, two cyber educators talking about ed tech pedagogy and expecting the unexpected. Welcome back, everyone. We are so excited that you're here listening. I wish that we were doing today a reflection episode on Diane's amazing podcast episode on Microsoft Class Notebook. Unfortunately, we have had to have a change of plans, and that is going to be the theme of today's episode. Expect the unexpected. So, Emily, do you want to go ahead and just give a quick recap of what exactly happened with our Microsoft pilot and why we have a slightly different episode than we originally had planned?
Well, we were so excited to start our Class Notebook pilot. We finished our recording our episode from Diane in the summer, and we were like brainstorming ideas, and we were going back and forth, and how can we make this happen? How can we do this happen? And then we started back to school in August, and all of a sudden, the first, I don't even think it was the first day, I think it was like the second or third day, that they come out and they tell us, oh, by the way, you can't do that Class Notebook pilot because we're not setting that up for students right now because we have so many more students than we had last year that they admin was and tech was working on fixing all of the other problems, and this one got shoved to the back burner. So we are very sad about this fact. We are really hoping next year they will activate it for us and we can actually do our reflection on Diane's podcast.
It was a little bit of a wah wah kind of moment. We were really excited. Definitely, I think Class Notebook has a lot to offer students. That being said, I think it is important to point out that Diane's interview had a lot of stuff that was really actionable about how to use that kind of platform. I know I really learned a lot. And coming into today's episode, we kind of want to speak to how you handle situations like this. I think many of us have had them this year because of COVID and because of sort of all of the different changes that are coming through. When you do have something that you've planned for and you've prepared for, how do you really pivot? In particular, we're going to talk a little bit about sort of how did this affect our particular classrooms, when we needed to pivot because we still needed to do writing and collaboration and all these projects that we sort of had planned. What did we sort of think about? What was our process like? What did we look for in particular programs? I think both Emily and I, even though we think in very similar ways about writing and writing education, we are doing things that are very different for how to solve this problem. So I think this is kind of an interesting episode, hopefully, for you guys to get to sort of unpack behind the scenes, how did we deal with these problems? But also, if you are now doing writing instruction in a virtual environment, this really is kind of an unpacking of what do we think are the really important things that have to be there in order to make that writing instruction really effective. So I'm really excited for today's episode, if for nothing more than just to kind of like give ourselves a little pat on the back of, you know what, sometimes things don't go the way you plan. And I think that this is a great opportunity for us to really reflect on all the things that we have learned about how to do writing in this environment and sort of make mistakes so you guys don't have to.
This is an episode full of fail forwards, for sure.
Get ready to hear them all. So let's go ahead and just like jump right on in. So Emily, how did this affect your classroom and writing in your classroom, sort of what you had planned? Talk to me sort of about what you were looking for in terms of a writing processor once you realized that Class Notebook couldn't be the thing.
Yeah, I know I talked about this on a different podcast, I think when we were reflecting on Eric's. I had this great idea for a current events article, and I was really excited because I was going to be able to put the template into Class Notebook, and I could see them as they worked, and it would be all nice and neat there for them. So I needed to figure out a way to do that. Also, graphic organizers. I have tried a variety of ways of graphic organizers in the past, and had not found one that I had fallen in love with. I still don't have one I fell in love with. But I was really hoping to be able to put graphic organizers in Class Notebook for the students to be able to fill out, and I could look and I could give feedback. But those were my two grand plans for class notebook that didn't happen.
Well, and I know I had a very similar kind of situation where I was really excited to use Class Notebook because, as everyone on the podcast knows, I had been using my Google System of Doom for years and years and years, and I had sort of become a little bit fatigued with it. For many reasons, Google had some limitations because we didn't have true Google for Education accounts and weren't using true Google Classroom. I sort of had to figure out a way to back-end engineer it so that it worked for the students. But it took a lot of time. And I think if there's one thing that I have really been reflecting on in the last several years of cyber teaching, it's that technology is great for a lot of the front end of teaching. It's wonderful for that direct instruction, for that direct practice, for manipulatives, for so many things. But like, you cannot replace the feedback and the intervention and sort of the expertise of the teacher. And in a cyber classroom, one of the things that you really have the opportunity to do is to let technology take that role of giving students the first pass at getting the information in so that I can spend more of my time and my energy looking at that data and really being targeted about my instruction. And that's the power of it. And at the end of the day, my Google System of Doom wasn't really letting me do that. It took so long just for me to set it up at the beginning of every year, for me to maintain it, for me to, you know, pass out assignments in it, that I was focusing more on the front end and less on the back end. And that was something that I personally wanted to change. When the school year started and we suddenly had a much higher enrollment than we're typically used to, I especially knew that I could not Google System of Doom because Google System of Doom took, you know, a certain amount of time, even with like a normal amount of students. So I had to figure out something else. And I was really interested in playing with some other programs that we had. I thought that Seesaw was probably the one that was going to save me. I sort of knew in the back of my mind, even as we were planning with this pilot, I knew that there were other teachers at the school who were using Seesaw. And I was interested to see if I could use that for my own writing process. So that starting the year, that was sort of the first thing that I did. Now, Emily, when it comes to looking for writing in online environments, what are some of the things that like you're looking for in a program or in a system to make sure that you can do writing instruction in an effective way?
I did switch to Seesaw for my graphic organizers. And some of that is because I rely a lot on graphic organizers, not just for organizing a writing piece, but for things like Venn diagrams to compare and contrast. I've used KWL charts sometimes, Frayer model graphic organizers. So when I was thinking all of these were grand things that I wanted to put into my class notebook that now I had to figure out how to do it, I settled on Seesaw. And the reason why I settled on Seesaw for at least the graphic organizer piece is that I knew I could put it as a background, as a template that would be there for the kids to write directly on top of. I really liked how Seesaw also has the voice recording feature, so they could talk to their graphic organizer if they needed to. I think for a lot of kids, and our students especially, some of them who really struggle with writing, it's easier for them to talk their ideas out than to write them. So we know that eventually they do need to write them, but that first step of doing a brain dump organization type thing, I don't care if they write that as long as they have it somehow.
And so many kids, I think, process better verbally or would be doing that in a kind of talk to text or talk to a partner. And those voice recordings are a really great way to simulate that.
I'm someone who talks. I talk to myself all the time.
or to me.
Yes. It's usually myself first, and then it's Allison, am I crazy for trying this idea? So I ended up using Seesaw for my graphic organizers and for my current events project. With that, I was able to put that template on the back of the Seesaw page. All of them are several pages long, so my kids already knew how to access Seesaw. And that was something that I also look for, was I don't want to add one more thing. how can I do this so it's already in something that they are familiar with or is easy to access. We do have ClassLink as our single sign-on, and Seesaw is directly on ClassLink. So they can just click the Seesaw. They don't have to worry about username and password. They are already going there for a couple of their other classes.
I was just about to say, we should mention that their math teacher has them using Seesaw pretty often. So that this was a program that they were very familiar with already.
So I definitely, that's something to keep in mind, especially in the cyber world where you have so many options sometimes, to be able to try to keep it to something they either already know or several teachers are using it on their team. So for us in seventh grade, if we're all using Seesaw, then that helps, as opposed to if I send them to some random program that nobody else is using, that's an even higher jump for our kids. So it worked. I'm still not sold on it. I do like it for the current events project. It is working really well for that. The students.
I was going to say, is there like a pros and cons sort of using Seesaw for you in terms of like these different projects and graphic organizers?
It is working great for the current events article. One of the only hiccup I have is because they do need to log in through Seesaw, there's nothing that I can put on our learning management system or LMS. I can't give them a direct link to go there, which sometimes has caused issues. The way I did a kind of workaround is I created a quote unquote assignment in our course that is for the current event article. And I say, once you're finished it in Seesaw, go into your course and submit it there. And all they have to do is say, I'm done. It's just a simple text box, but that allows me to tie it to the gradebook and include the, graphic organizer, include the rubric on it. But that extra step sometimes doesn't always get done, which is fine from that. Like if they do it in Seesaw and they don't submit it, I can make that work. But there are a handful of kids who consistently will submit their assignment and not
their empty assignment. Exactly.
Yeah. So I send them emails. Hey, you need to do it in Seesaw first. That is one of the downfalls, which is one of the reasons why it is not a perfect system, which I don't know if that would have been fixed by Class Notebook or not. I'm not sure with that. But I do like how I can leave feedback, and it's really easy to leave feedback in Seesaw. So you can either do writing, like I can type a comment, or I can also do audio feedback for them there too. I really like being able to do that, especially for the graphic organizers, where I can say, this part was good, tweak that or change that, or what were you thinking with this piece of evidence that you put in here? So with those, I've liked that aspect, but I'm not sold on Seesaw either.
Are there certain things that you're looking for, or like what are those limitations if you're like, man, I'm not really feeling these particular aspects of Seesaw?
I think one of the things with the graphic organizer piece is they do their graphic organizer in Seesaw and then they have to write it somewhere else, because it's not like you can write in Seesaw, but it doesn't work the best. Formatting gets funky. Sometimes they have trouble changing the text boxes. So my students right now have to do their graphic organizer in Seesaw, and then I've just been having them write their essay or whatever in a discussion board. So they have to take what they wrote in Seesaw and then turn it into an actual writing on a discussion board, which that step sometimes doesn't happen. They're pretty good about doing it, but that whole flipping back and forth, I know we've talked before, I have two monitors, so I always put things on one monitor to look at and then type on the other one, but they don't have that. So it's a lot of flipping back and forth, assuming that they did the graphic organizer in the first place.
Well, and I should also throw out that Emily's discussion board posting, these are private discussion boards. The way that our learning management system works, you can create groups. And one of the ways to do writing, this is back in the day before the Google system of doom, this was how I did it, was that I made an individual group in the learning management system for each kid. And then when you made a discussion board post, you could basically turn on a setting that allowed it to only post to the people in that group. So then each kid would end up writing essentially a discussion board only to themselves, which was great in a lot of ways. There are some flaws with that system that moved me over to Google System of Doom that I'll talk about in a minute. But absolutely, it at least gives them, this is a place for you to do a graphic organizer and to like brain dump and talk to text and kind of like get all that stuff out there. And then this is a place where you can write something that is much more curated and refined and turn it in the system so that it's completed.
And I do have those individual groups already set up because I do something that I call a journal. And so that's where that is designed to be a discussion board only to them. Our LMS did also make it a lot easier this year to create those individual groups. So I was able, this is the first year this has happened, I was able to set them up at the beginning of the year, and now it was like three clicks. And with that, with the new way of setting them up, new students are automatically added to their own individual group. So once I set it up at the beginning of the year, now that aspect is taken care of for me by the technology, which is really nice because there were definitely times last year that a kid would be like, I can't see it. And it was a new student and I had forgotten to make them their own group. So that huge time saver this year with that.
Whenever those enrollments, I think, can be automatic, right? Because that's, to me, this is the stuff that's like, it's frustrating. I do sometimes enjoy like playing the game of, how can I get this stuff system and this system to work together to like play nicely. But during the year, I feel like this is like the most hair-raising thing for teachers is trying to jerry-rig a system to work a certain way when really like you don't want to be sitting there doing like it is a waste of time on some level to be managing just making groups and doing all that kind of stuff. Like our best time is in intervening and working with and like taking the data and like using that in a certain way with students. And so the less time that you can be spending there, I think absolutely the better. Do you have like a takeaway or a, like I feel like you and I have talked an awful lot. We both had kind of a rough start to the school year, I think in many ways. We were expecting, I think, a jump in enrollment, and I know Emily, you were expecting to sort of this new curriculum on top of it. And I think the lack of this, it was just like a lot to sort of have all at once. Did you feel like there was a particular takeaway that you were like, man, I really had to practice what I preach in terms of this particular idea or this particular focus?
Definitely. It has been a crazy year. Crazy, really only first quarter because we only just ended the first quarter. Like it feels like it should be May. That's what things have been like this year. But I have really this year been trying, which sometimes I have been successful, sometimes not, of letting go of my high expectations of myself because I consistently have 40 plus kids in my virtual classrooms. I have over 150 to grade, give feedback for, do all of that. So I'm really trying to remember that phrase of like, don't let perfect be the enemy of good enough, because there are so many things that I feel like I should be doing that maybe aren't as necessary. But this first quarter has felt forever. I'm consistently like on the computer until 11 and at least one day of the weekend and just trying to figure out where I can scale back without it affecting the kids, which is that fine line of do I have to do this or am I just doing it to make my lessons look pretty or something?
Well, and that to me, I think that there is an advantage that I think you and I are coming to this year with, that I think that like if you're in your first like couple years of teaching, I think is very difficult, which is you have a sense for and you have data on what parts of your teaching are most effective. And I know, like, I have been thinking that to myself a lot, which are like, these are the things that really matter, right? When it comes to moving kids from point A to point B, I would love to have all six of these items. I can't. I can have three. Which ones are the ones that like really move the needle most effectively? And maybe there's one more that I'm like, oh, man, it really breaks my heart that this can't be in there because it is effective, but these other things are more effective. And so there's an element of prioritizing. And I think that happens whenever there's a shift, right, like this. I think there's multiple shifts happening, and that's what's sort of tricky about this situation is, you know, you planned for, like, we planned really for a pilot, and then we planned for a certain number of kids, and we planned for a certain curriculum. And then when those things change, you sort of have to say, like, okay, you know, backing up a lot, what are the things that have to be there? Because it can stack. And that's, to me, that's what I'm trying to remind myself is like, you are laying a foundation of those first three things. And when you come in next year, all of those three things are going to be there. You may have to do some tweaking based on data that you've collected and things that you figured out. But like, for the most part, those three things are going to be there. And so now you can add four and five. And in, you know, another year, you'll have all six. So like, you're going to get to that highest level with what you're trying to make. It's just, it's going to take a little bit more time.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of my issue is I think about what I was doing last year when I had been teaching the same curriculum for 8 out of my 9 years, and I had finally gotten to a point where I was just tweaking and making better and being like, I know this didn't work, so we can do this. And I'm just not there with this one. And I feel like, personally, I feel like I'm not living up to what I know I can do. But I have to remember that because I'm spending so much time essentially teaching myself the curriculum, I mean, it's civics, so I have a good base, but does the curriculum suggest how to approach these things? What words do they suggest that we use? All of that. That is taking the lion's share of my time as opposed to my, let's go find a really engaging activity to go with this topic.
Right. But and having those bones, right? You have to have that deep understanding of the content before you can do anything else, right? Like, you are required for not just your expertise in terms of learning and learning progressions, but on the subject matter, right? And so that's going to take some time to like really get sort of cemented. In some ways, I ended up in a similar situation to you, very unexpectedly. So we had what I don't think any of us in ELI 7 thought was going to be a big deal. Our textbook was like literally going from like a volume, like version one to like a version two. It's not actually version one and version two, but it was just being updated. So we assumed that there would be maybe a couple of stories changed, maybe a little vocabulary, some different questions, nothing too crazy. And what we found was that like 75% of the texts that were included were different. So we basically ended up, you know, in ELA, it's not quite the same in terms of your whole curriculum. For example, you know, my pacing of grammar didn't change too much. But so much of what we do revolves around, you know, we're teaching these texts together, what standards go here, and then what writing projects can we do that complement or that sort of go together with things. And we really had to do a lot of sort of maneuvering and moving around. And so it ended up being as if we had changed curriculums, even though technically we didn't. It was just an update to the textbook. But in some ways, I'm really like thankful that it happened, if that makes sense, because I felt like I had been teaching the same curriculum for a long time. And I think that because there were certain lessons that I always did a certain way, and they were like pretty effective, that there were leaps in my teaching that I did not take because I didn't want to completely remake everything associated with a unit or everything about a learning progression. And I think when you're forced to do that, you can ask yourself, if I had to build this from scratch, knowing what I know now, what things would I really put in place, right? I made the bare bones of a lot of this material, you know, I guess like 7 years ago in my teaching. That was a very different time for me. And so I've really, it has been a lot of work and it has been a lot of time, but I do feel that the bare bones of what I'm building out now are the bare bones of something great. And like in 3 years, this is going to be like the most beautiful curriculum ever. And right now it's good. Like it's solid. It's good. It's moving kids. I'm seeing the data, right? Like it's effective. But like, it's not as pretty. and there are a lot of fail forwards.
So what were some of those fail forwards that you had?
Well, my biggest one was Seesaw. Seesaw was like, I know you had like tremendous success with it. And I remember being so jealous because I was like, what did Emily do that was like so great? My kids like flubbed this first assignment. This was not so great. And I should say they did not flub this first assignment, right? Like when you're a teacher, it's sort of how you set up, right? Like my setup did not, I think, allow them to get the most out of the assignment that they possibly could. And I learned a lot from trying to use Seesaw because it was so different than the other systems that I had used. I really think that there are certain things that have to be there for online writing instruction, and a bunch of them Seesaw just like couldn't deliver for me. And so I really struggled to teach the way that I knew how to teach. I need a word processor. Like it needs to be a true to form word processor, integrates with spell check and grammar check and formatting and all of those things. And Seesaw couldn't do that for me. It couldn't integrate with Grammarly, for example, which is something that I asked the students like all to download because it's a really great instructional tool for teaching them about what things are supposed to go where and why. Like I use this as part of my normal instruction and it didn't integrate. And so I think there were kids who got like hung up on, I am so busy trying to figure out like, is a word spelled correctly, that they were sort of missing some of the bigger picture stuff about the writing process. As Emily kind of mentioned, there was a lot of like text boxes. And so as they were trying to put together sentence structure, we were doing an essay for our very first writing assignment. And I have a way that I teach essay writing, which is where you kind of almost give the kids a script. It's like, it's very prescriptive in the beginning. And it's meant to be, right? A lot of the students that I'm working with are below grade level in some capacity. And so having something that is almost like sentence starters kind of scripted to help them get the format of an essay just so that they can understand their flow. And then with the students who can handle it, I then am like, okay, now let's teach you the flourishes, right? Let's get some hooks in here. Let's do some different things with transitions, right? Like let's think about how we can make this cooler, mightier, awesome, right? But for some students, like they're going to be on that script all year. And that's a huge deal for them just to be able to do that. But it requires you to think about the job of each sentence, the job of each paragraph. And so I would get like a block that was like a sentence and then another block that was another sentence. And rather than being below each other, they were like next to each other. So I didn't feel like the students could really get the flow of an essay, which is something that they need to understand, right? You need to sort of understand how it works together as one whole with all of these different parts with very different jobs. I'm always looking for something that saves drafts and you can easily send them back. The big thing that got me off of using our current LMS system and doing what Emily does, where she does the discussion boards, was that it was really, really difficult when kids would save something and then accidentally turn it into me. It was really hard to like send back a draft. Like you couldn't really do it. They had to sort of create a new draft. And that was really complicated. And I loved in my Google system of Doom that everything saved automatically, that it could always be updated automatically, right? Everything was kind of there. And that was something that was really nice in Seesaw. I think that Seesaw did a great job with that. It is something where it's very easy to see the drafts that are in progress, who's working, who's not, all that kind of stuff. Awesome did a great job there. I also want real time, right? Like you have to be having them write live in the classroom and your ability to jump in is really important. I have often asked the students to app share while they're doing their writing in class, which basically means sort of putting them in a private breakout room and the kids are all sharing their screens. Sometimes that can be a problem when you're talking about large volume of kids because it can slow down the processor for the computer or for the classroom, for the virtual classroom. And not all virtual classroom setups have that ability. So Seesaw was pretty good because I could say to students, you know, I want everybody to turn it in at the end of the day or save their draft. And I could see what they were doing, who hadn't got it started, and give feedback sort of on where they were in that process. So it was enough real time that I was still able to do what I needed to do. But that I think is a very important part of that system. And it's the big reason that I don't just have them use Word on their computer, for example. I can't see what you're doing there. I can't see where you saved it. I can't, like, it may not save automatically. If you lose it in you know, the craziness of your files, there's nothing that I can do to save you. So I like it to be on an application or something where there's something that I can do if something goes wrong. I can sort of see where you are in that process. But if not, you'll always get, you know, students who, you know, start something and then lose it, or say they're working, you know, when they're actually on YouTube. So you want to have that level of accountability there. A simple feedback system is really important. I did think that for Seesaw, this was pretty good. There was the ability for me to leave notes that were easily accessible for the students. And there were notifications for the student and the teacher. The only bummer is I did think that it was tricky because when the students log into Seesaw, each class that they have in Seesaw, they have to like go up into the corner and then change the view so they can see these are your Seesaw assignments in math, these are your Seesaw assignments in history, these are your Seesaw assignments in English. I would have liked it better if there was some sort of like almost like a dashboard where a student could see, I went in for math and I saw that I had a notification in English rather than having to change that view. That's important sometimes for students who aren't as great about checking their feedback, right? It allows you whenever you log in, you know, if a student is absent or had to be asynchronous for that day or something, it just allows you more points of contact with that feedback sort of just in case. And finally, that integration of graphic organizers and writing really in those prose sections, right? I want the experience that a kid would have in a brick and mortar where their graphic organizer is on one side of the desk and the paper you're writing on or wherever you're, you know, typing is right next to you. And Seesaw was okay for this because you could create different pages where a student could like see the graphic organizer and then be writing, you know, an introduction paragraph. But the problem was that you are shifting back and forth between those different pages. You couldn't have like one on one screen and one on the other. And so I felt like it was a little bit cumbersome to make that connection, once again, as a word processor. That being said, there's a lot, like, please do not feel that I am hating on Seesaw. I love Seesaw. There's a ton of stuff that I think it's really good for. I think it's for creative projects. I think there's nothing better. And I'm really excited to bring back, you know, this in other things that we do, making posters, making creative projects. There's a portfolio project that the kids always do every year with poetry. I think this is like a slam dunk for it. So I think it's really good for a lot of things, but for the very particular kind of essay writing and, you know, prose work and like things where you're really talking about written organization and written expression, like it just didn't hold up for me. And I was kind of bummed because I sort of felt like, oh man, I really don't want to go back to the Google system of doom. I really don't want to use Seesaw again, right? Like I felt like the students were really struggling with getting in, finding the materials. And I don't ever want the navigation to take away from the instruction. And so I think this was a place where I could have set up a little bit better.
I agree. Like I feel like this is also where we're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. Because none of the programs that we have access to are a true word processor type thing, which Class Notebook was going to solve that problem, but we will have to wait. What did you end up deciding on to use, or have you decided on something?
Okay, so bear with me, but I actually have a pretty cool idea. And I think that like if there is a lesson to this, it is to ask yourself, what can you do when you're in situations like this? I had to kind of flash back to a moment that I had. I think it was literally my first year of teaching. And it was during a year when phone calls and family reach out was like the big theme of the year, which is very, very important, especially if you're in cyber. If you're not making contact with families, if you're not sort of like really putting a lot of effort into reaching out, it's very easy for families to feel, you know, disconnected from you, or like you're not like a real person on the other end of the phone. And I remember in our first year, we were asked to make at least 5 phone calls every day, reaching out with a family. You didn't have to necessarily have a conversation and connect with them, but like make 5 attempts at a phone call and like have the phone calls that you could. And I remember thinking to myself, it was like, once again, it was my first year. I was completely overwhelmed. I can't do that. Like, there's no way that I can do everything I'm doing now and make 5 phone calls a day, right? Like, there's just not able to do it. But I remember saying to myself, okay, if I can't do that, what can I do, right? Like, how many calls can I make? What can I do in this situation? Because if I'm in a conversation with my supervisor later, I want to be able to show, you know, I was given a directive to make more phone calls and I made more phone calls. Did I make like the number that, you know, I was asked to? Maybe not, but like I've made progress in this direction. And so that usually is my indicator in situations like this, where I'm sort of thinking to myself, something feels really impossible. You know, how can I just push more forward than I can? For me, the answer was to try using Actively Learn as a writing processor. And this is a little bit like different than the program was designed to be used, but there is that ability to import your own PDF or your own Word doc. And so what I'm thinking that I can do is basically set up so that I have the chunk of text that students are close reading right at the top, instruct students through highlighting, annotating, doing all the cool stuff in the program. And as I think Emily has mentioned on the podcast before, you can do some really interesting things in terms of Actively Learn, in terms of jumping students to different points in the reading and being able to point them to the things that different students are saying. So for me, this seems like a really great instructional tool to get the students highlighting evidence and, you know, doing that kind of scaffolding work that I want in the beginning. And then immediately underneath, you can create open-ended questions. I'm sort of toying with having each paragraph being an open-ended question, as opposed to, you know, do I just want to use one open-ended question and put a whole essay in there? But I did beta test this when I was doing sort of like my round one, and I looked to see, is it possible for me to put a whole essay in one of those boxes? And I got like an outrageous number of characters in one of those boxes and got it to post. It will absolutely post, you know, the 5 paragraph essay that I'm asking my students to write. So that's kind of what I'm going to try next. Is they're already using Actively Learn for all of their readings for the year. So it kind of makes sense that it would be the place that they would go for an assignment. It easily marks at the front, this assignment is undone. So even in a version of the world where we move on to unit 3 and a student doesn't complete an assignment, the next time that they log in, they're going to see, this assignment is here. And they're going to be able to walk through each of the steps of reading through the passage, doing the pieces of it that are highlighting and annotating, and then moving them into the actual space where they can be writing that essay and turning it in. I think there's also something to be open for if students do want to use a word processor on a computer. I'm trying to be more flexible about that this year, if they are also going to, during the live writing sessions, application share with me so that I can in real time see what they're doing. If you want to do it in Word and then copy it into Actively Learn to turn it into me, like we can absolutely make that happen. So I'm trying to sort of like be flexible and find a way to make sure that the students really get the connection between, you know, this is an essay that you're writing, sure, but the purpose of an essay is to promote your ideas. It's to help someone better understand the reason that you believe what you believe. And everything about the essay has to go back to that text, right? There has to be that connection. And I think that Actively Learn does a pretty good job with that. So we will, I'm sure, have a follow-up at the end of our school year where we talk about where we sort of end up with these programs in terms of writing and all that kinds of stuff. But it has been a little bit of a tricky situation, sort of being caught between the old way and the new way. But I do think that it is pushing me to think about what do I really care about in terms of the writing instruction, and the kids are making pretty good gains, even in the seesaw assignment where I, you know, I'm sort of sitting here saying, oh, it wasn't the best. You know, students did make gains and they did complete the assignment and they did learn things. So I'm excited to see how the growth kind of continues.
Holly would be so proud. We're
I hope so. I hope so.
We're using Great. Actively Learn in a totally new, innovative way. There's our KTI shout out, innovate.
There you go. There you go. Well, and that's one of the things I love about it is that back and forth that you can have with those answers. Like one of the reasons I'm willing to try this is in part because it's really easy to give and receive feedback for all of the different sections. So like I'm hoping that that will carry through into what I try. It may be a total disaster, but I kind of feel like this is that time to take risks. It goes back to what I said at the beginning. I have to be willing to like really put it out there and try something new if I'm going to try to get the best results that I can for the students, right? And I do think that this is an opportunity where if I have to remake everything anyway, we may as well remake it like the strongest it can possibly be, and be willing to sort of be open to different things.
I think that is the perfect segue into our listener question for this week. Ooh. as we are figuring things out on our own here, we got this question. If you are using an interactive slides program like Nearpod or Pear Deck, do you even need to use the features of the virtual classroom? How would that work? Allison, I'm going to let you start with this one.
All right. So I have been doing a lot with using Nearpod this year. This is one of the big remakes, is that if I'm remaking all of my slide-based lessons anyway, I'm remaking them integrated with Nearpod. I am not as familiar with Pear Deck. I've used it quite a ton, but I haven't used it in my own classroom because we are Nearpod people over here. The two pieces of advice that I have are that there is, I think, something to be said for making sure that that classroom space, so whether it is what we're using, Blackboard Collaborate or Zoom or Google Meet or something like that, that space still be considered sort of the primary learning space. And then that your Pear Deck or your Nearpod, your interactive slide, becomes the thing that the student is interacting with. It's the difference between the classroom and like the worksheet or the packet or the desk work that the student would be doing in a brick and mortar classroom. So for me, that means that I will have oftentimes a slide deck that I'm moving through on the main screen. And when it comes time for the students to do an activity, I'll have a picture of this is what it looks like in the student view on your Nearpod, your Pear Deck. This is what I want you to be doing right now. And so they know to go in and to do that activity or to, you know, do whatever that thing is. And there's a very clear, you know, there's a thing on the screen that is telling you to go now to your activity. Or sometimes I will have something that helps them do that activity. I often will do, we've read a passage, we've done a close reading, we've highlighted as a class, and now I'm going to keep those highlights up while you are writing something in your Nearpod or in your Pear Deck. So you want to think about how you can pair them. The biggest mistake that I see, though, is what I call the Russian doll of slides program problem, which is where you have a set of interactive slides that the students are going through. And either it's duplicated so that whatever on being shared on the screen is also what students are supposed to be going through on their own page. The reason that I don't like this is because I always get behind if it's like student paced, because I'm watching in the main room, I'm looking at the chat, I'm looking at whatever the instructor is doing live on the page. Is she pointing at something or writing something or doing something to interact with whatever is on those slides? And then I'm like four slides behind when I need to actually go do the activity. So it keeps it out of sync. Sometimes you'll often see the issue of links. This is a big issue with Pear Deck in particular. When you click on a link in Pear Deck, it will open the link to whatever other material. Maybe it's a site for the students to read, or it's an audio file, or it's something, and it will open in another browser tab. So now I've gone from already having to navigate two different browser tabs, the Nearpod and the classroom, to navigating three and sometimes four, because there'll be like a link to something else. And it truly reminds me of a Russian doll where like you have to follow the links and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger as you go. It's like, I guess it would be a reverse Russian doll then, right? Because they get smaller and smaller in Russian dolls. So I really think that especially with Pear Deck in particular, it is better to really think about the main classroom space, your Google Meet, your Zoom, your Blackboard Collaborate, whatever you have as the main space, and then think of your interactive slide as your desk work, and sort of imagine that dichotomy in the mind. So I don't think it has to be a perfect one for one. Each of the slides need to be the same. It should be really targeted. Those are the activities. Those are the way that I want the students to interact, is through that medium. But I always want them to be coming back to what I'm doing in the classroom, what I'm pointing at in the classroom, what they're discussing in the chat box, and letting that space sort of operate as the classroom space. But Emily, I know you have a lot of thoughts on this, on Nearpod in particular, because this is definitely your jam and you've been using this in this way in this live setting for a very long time.
This is one that definitely depends on if you are using Nearpod or if you are using Pear Deck, because of that whole link issue. I will put all of my links that I need in my Nearpod, because in Nearpod, it all opens in that same window. So there's never any tabs that pop out. So you can easily keep them, keep your students still in the Nearpod, but sending them to a website to do a specific thing.
Just to sort of help you visualize what Emily is describing, what that means is that instead of opening in another browser tab, let's pretend you were going to have students go to a website to read something that was relevant to the course material that you're doing, it will almost basically make a window inside of the Nearpod that allows you to see and interact with the site. So basically, you don't have to leave the Nearpod. The Nearpod is around the site, and they're interacting with it in the center of that window. Is that a decent way of explaining it, Em?
Yes. Now, that does sometimes run into the issue where if you move off from it, then it closes for them, which usually I like. But so by having everything controlled in there, you don't have to have links everywhere, which for, like, we can put links on our whiteboard, but I know not everybody, like Zoom or Google Meet doesn't let you do that. So it's a little trickier in that way. The other thing I do, which Allison kind of is like what you do, is if I'm having them do some sort of open-ended question where I want them to reference the text, I will put the text in as it's called a reference image. So they can click it right in the Nearpod to open bigger to be able to see that. I will also put it on the board put it on the Blackboard board. The other thing that I do is at the beginning of the recording, I will start my recording before I have any students log in, and I will, in that 30-second recording, not even, give the student-paced lesson. Because if I'm doing a teacher-paced lesson for my students, anybody who is watching the recording won't be able to access that because as a teacher, I've closed it. But if I record the student-paced link the very beginning, then anyone who is watching the recording can open up their student-paced link and follow along with us. So I'll just start the recording. I will say, if you're watching the recording and following along with class today, here is the link to the Nearpod. And then I will pause the recording. And once all my students are there and I'm ready to start actually recording, I will record the rest of class. That helps with students who are like, but I'm not in class, how can I do it? That solves that problem. But again, I think this is really dependent on what you are, if you're using Nearpod or Pear Deck, because they work similarly, but there are some pretty significant differences in how you can deliver your content.
I think that's a great way to put it, Emily. I do something very similar with Nearpod, where we post our recordings for the students to see, because we do have some students that are asynchronous, so they don't necessarily come to the live sessions. And then they can follow along and be completing that activity, and I'll see that activity on the same report as my other students. So I can see, even if they're doing it at a different time, you know, how is that student doing? I'm still monitoring their progress in pretty real time. One of the other big things to keep in mind, I think, with this question is, and I didn't do the best job of it. We told you at the beginning there's going to be a lot of fail forwards in this episode. This was a huge mistake that I made right at the very beginning. Because I was doing a lot of live pace with Nearpod instruction this year, was that you're going to have students, if you're teaching in this way, who for some reason, whatever it is, cannot get into the Nearpod that day. Their, you know, Wi-Fi is running slow. They need to clear their cache. There's something going on. And particularly at the beginning of the year, you know, you're not always able to get in an application share and like do the tech work with them while you're also teaching a live lesson. And so what's nice is if you have, once again, you're thinking of your main classroom slides as the main classroom space, you can create backup situations for those students who are kind of the one-off. So for example, the other day, I had a student who could not get into the Nearpod. I said, your job is to watch what's going on in class. And when the students are responding, you're going to respond to me in the chat box instead. And for two of the three assignments, that worked great because the students were writing on a Collaborate board and then writing in an open-ended question. For one of the assignments, though, they were doing a matching activity. And so I was able to send him in the chat box privately, okay, the other students are doing this matching activity. I want you instead to, it was all about the different kinds of conflicts. So they were matching examples of a conflict to the kind of conflict on the different cards so that they knew, you know, this is an example of man versus nature. This is an example of man versus society or something like that. I want you to tell me, these are the four types. I've written them in your chat box for you. I want you to tell me off, you know, what, based on what you can think of, make up four different kinds of examples that would go with each of these particular examples. And it's not a perfect overlay, but it still allows that student to be involved in the class. A couple of times, now this is very, I think, particular to Blackboard Collaborate, I've had students who maybe we were doing some sort of thing where the students were highlighting or filling in a graphic organizer on their page. We're doing a lot with plot right now. So we're doing a Freytag's triangle in class. And so for layman's terms, that is a plot mountain or a plot volcano or a plot diagram.
Thank you for that, because I didn't know what
that was. I for a minute there, I was like in my you know, English literature, you know, higher level self. So we're working on this plot mountains, right? And for a lot of what we were doing in this one class was filling out our plot diagram based on the reading that we had done the following day. Well, the student obviously couldn't do it in Nearpod. So what I had him do instead was having him work in a private breakout room that I had just copied the slide. And when it was time for them to fill something out, he could jump down into the room, fill it out on his page, and then pop back up when he was done. And it was, you know, just that simple. So there's more, I feel like there's a little more work around. But you always have to be thinking about what will happen when, and it is not an if, it is a when, there are students that cannot log in. What is their recourse? What is that backup that still allows them to complete activities?
There are always tech issues. I like that. It's not an if, it's a when. There's always the when.
So hopefully that helps a little bit with our listener question. This one actually came from Emily's session. She did a really great Nearpod conference this last weekend, and we are all super proud of her because she literally did presentations to like 300 people, were in one of your sessions.
Yeah, it was a little crazy.
Girl, that is amazing. Like I have heard nothing but wonderful things from those who were able to see you. So if you are one of our new listeners from one of those sessions, hi, shout out. We're very excited to have you here with our Cyber Sisters family. Really, really great stuff, I think, that came out of that. But that was one of the big questions that Emily heard from many people, was about sort of how you integrate that into cyber teaching and into live lesson-paced learning. So I hope that you have found this episode to be helpful. It is a little bit more narrative than some of our more recent episodes, but that happens sometimes. I think we're all sort of trying to deal with, you know, changes and unexpected things in this year. And we're doing it too, you know, in our own way and in our own time. But I do think that one of the great things about teachers is that in general, we are a profession of problem solvers. Like if there's something that teachers do really well, we are professional problem solvers. There's never, you know, two kids that learn exactly the same that come into a classroom. So we're constantly facing a situation where you have a brand new person that you need to tweak and, you know, investigate and find ways to support. That just sort of never changes about the profession. And so I do think that if anybody can do it, we can do it, teachers can do it, and get us through this on year. And with that, thank you for joining us on the Cyber Sisters podcast. Please keep in touch with us on our socials. We're on Twitter at AllisonKTeaches and at Sattler Cyber. We always appreciate keeping the conversation going, and we'd love to hear about some of your fail forwards, unexpected moments, or your suggestions for writing in the cyber environment. Please like, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, keep trying hard.